We are ready for Revelation chapter 7, Revelation 7 verses 1 through 3. We have provided some introductory material. We've gone over numerology. We're going to see some Bible numbers in this chapter, especially the number 4 towards the beginning of the chapter. And we want to bear in mind that this continues to build. The background, of course, would be Revelation 6. John has talked about 6 of the 7 seals in Revelation 6. Revelation 8, we'll talk about the 7th seal. But here's some information in between those seals. After this, I saw 4 angels standing at the 4 corners of the earth, holding the 4 winds of the earth, that no wind should blow on the earth, or on the sea, or upon any tree. And I saw another angel ascend from the sun rising, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a great voice to the 4 angels, to whom it was given to hurt the earth and sea, saying, "Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till..." And that, I think, is an important word. Don't do the hurting till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. Now, it's been a little while since we were there. But back in Revelation chapter 6, we went through the various seals. Remember the first seal, Jesus, we said, is riding on that white horse. And his goal is to go ahead and continue to harvest souls throughout the Christian era. As he's harvesting those souls, we then continue to talk about some of the other seals to discuss what some of God's people will experience as Jesus is, you know, harvesting souls during the Christian dispensation. We said that some are going to suffer persecution. Some are going to suffer economic hardship. There are going to be various problems that God's people face. You still have to bear in mind that we're still talking about this great spiritual harvest during the Christian era. As Christ continues to harvest those souls, Revelation 7 kind of gives us some additional information as far as some things that will come to pass. And here in the first 3 verses, you see angels pictured, 4 angels standing at the 4 corners of the earth. Do you think that they are standing here to bless the earth or do something that's not so favorable? Bless the earth or hurt the earth? They're going to hurt the earth. And hurt has the sense, I think, of destroy. When we look at these angels, we might think of them not as evil angels, but as good angels that have the ability or have the authority to go ahead and be involved in the earth's destruction. We do want to run some cross-references here. I'll pick up the first one. It comes from the Old Testament, the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 49:36. We've often said that John has some information in the book of Revelation, maybe about half the material that's drawn from the Old Testament. And here you see, I think, an example of that. "And upon Elam will I bring the 4 winds from the 4 quarters of heaven, and will scatter them toward all those winds, and there shall be no nation, whether the outcasts of Elam shall not come." So John picks up this imagery, this idea of the 4 winds and so forth, and it is the idea of destruction. Now back there in Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17, as John talked about seal 6, the 6th seal, as I understand it, describes the end of time. You know, the Lord comes back, and that's going to bring us really to the point of eternity. And then the 7th seal, just like the 7th trumpet, and the 7th plague, will deal with things associated with eternity. But the 6th is going to bring us right up until the end. All right, bearing that background in mind as far as Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 17, it is going to come. But Revelation 7 says it's not going to come till. It's not going to occur until something occurs. Well, what is that? Remember back there in Revelation 6? What's Jesus doing? He's scouring the earth for souls, for people who want to be saved. We talked about this before in some preceding classes. We can use several examples from the Old Testament. You think about Sodom. Were all the righteous people extracted from that area? Yeah, they were. And I mean, you know, Lot and his family, they get out and then it's just the unbelievers left. What about Noah and his family? Were all the righteous people extracted? Everybody gets on board. Now, granted, you do have some people who are not accountable, you know, the young. But as far as the people who want to be saved, the people who can make a conscious decision, they're old enough to know right from wrong and they get on board, literally or figuratively with God, and they make the decision to become a Christian. I've proposed in previous classes, and now we're dealing with this in a more direct way as we come to Revelation 7, this same principle seems to me to be associated with the end of time. The Lord is not going to come until each person, given all the opportunities that they have, will take those opportunities to become a Christian, and God will extract from the earth every single person that based on their life and opportunity, would choose to become a Christian. And that's really what's pictured here in the first three verses of Revelation 7. Now, we've talked before about numerals. And when we think about the numeral 4, anybody remember what 4 is associated with? Man and his world, man and his environment. North, south, east, west, the four seasons, and so forth. So if you have these four angels, that would immediately kind of cue you that, well, hey, these angels are probably involved with what? Man and his environment. And if they're standing at the four corners of the earth, that helps nail it down a little bit more, doesn't it? Once again, we're talking about man and his world. And these, as we mentioned from Jeremiah chapter 49, 36, these are going to be the destroying angels. Now, it's interesting to me that, and people probably had good intentions, but way back when, as people were trying to sort through some information in the book of Revelation and do some things in the secular realm, if you go back and you look at some ancient map drawers, some ancient map makers, you would find that some of the ancient map drawers drew the world as a rectangle. They literally thought that there would be, you think about a rectangle, you have how many corners? Four corners. So they come over here to Revelation 7, well, the earth has four corners, therefore we're going to draw this shape. See, the earth is a rectangle. And then if you could go back and look at some of these ancient maps, you not only would see the four corners, but what do you think that you have stationed at the four corners? Four angels, which were terrible-looking beasts. So they took a very literal approach to this, but that's not really John's point. It was natural for God, very logical for God and John to use this numeral to say that man's world is being preserved until a specific time. Now, there are some things, and we'll see this in Revelation 8 as well, that are a little difficult. As we look at these angels, they get a message. God's not going to allow any wind to blow on the earth, the sea, or any tree. We're not told what these forces, the winds, the trees, and the so forth may represent. My best suggestion is that they probably tie in with what's already been said. God says, hey, man's environment, the earth, the trees, and so forth, all this is going to continue. Things are going to, we're going to have some tornadoes and hurricanes and things, but your environment is going to continue till when? What have we said? What's the Lord doing now in the Christian dispensation? Going to and fro the earth, looking for people who want to become Christians. And God says this cycle of evangelism, this cycle of letting the world, you know, continue to exist, it's going to continue. We're not going to mess things up until, once again, all the souls have been harvested. When that has taken place, it will be at that point, then man's environment is going to cease. The Bible tells us in several places that the world is one day going to end. Maybe one of the more popular passages is 2 Peter chapter 3. Remember, Peter says at the end of time, everything's going to be burned up. In the book of Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 12, the Hebrew writer talked about, as a mantle, as garments, you know, just as we would fold up garments, put them away, put them in the closet, put them in the dresser. The Bible promises that God's one day going to do a similar thing. But he's not going to do away with these items until his will has been fulfilled. As we mentioned, this will, of course, is extracting from the earth everybody who wants to be saved. Bearing this in mind, what will we say about the theories today that people sometimes point? Well, there's going to be a nuclear disaster and it's going to, you know, blow up the whole earth. Or there's going to be some asteroid that's going to smash the earth and we're all going to die. Now, biblically, what would you say to these claims? They're not true. Because God says your environment is going to continue till when? Till the end. Till we've extracted every possible soul. So when we look at the scriptures and we hear these things from different folks today, I think that's an important point. It's probably reading far too much into the text, but there was a fellow who made this observation. And I don't think this is John's point, but I do think that the sentiment is probably true. He says, not a single leaf of any tree can stir in the breeze without God's permission, nor can anything of a larger and more serious nature occur to hinder his plan and purpose to save the elect. We sing songs sometimes. Remember, it is my Father's world. Well, I believe that those words are expressing a lot of helpful information. All right, I've got a little more to say, but let's see if there's anything that you want to add or ask at this point. Revelation 7, 1 through 3. Okay, a couple of the things.
Now, this is talking, so there's actually five angels here, right?
Yes, and I'm getting ready to talk about the angel in verse 2. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to not go through the whole thing, but try to divide it up a little bit. Okay, yeah. And in verse 2, we come to a new angel. We've got the four angels, you know, here, symbolizing, you know, man, his environment, the total environment, and then now we come to this creature. And he's described as ascending from somewhere. Where's he coming from? He's coming out of the east. Or the ASV says he's coming from the sun rising. We are not given a lot of information about this particular angel. Well, anytime people don't have a lot of information, they're prone to speculation. Well, it must be this, or it could be this, or maybe it's this. In this particular case, some people have said, well, it represents Jesus. I think that's probably not real likely, because the Lord is never described as an angel, at least an angel in the sense that we think of it. He's certainly not a created being. An angel would mean that someone or something is less than God or less than deity, and that's not true of the Father. Deity is pictured as like a sun and a shield. That's true. Psalm 84:11. Jesus is called the Son of Righteousness. Malachi 4 verse 2. And then later in Revelation 22:16, he's called the Bright Morning Star. But I'm more inclined to think that this is probably a fifth angel, as Steve mentioned, a separate angel, but not Jesus. All right, we do.
I think it's ascending instead of descending.
Yes.
Hmm? You would think of them, you know, automatically descending.
Yes. Right. It is ascending. And that's exactly how he's pictured. There may be a reason for that. If we think about the image that John has given us, you have four angels. They're stationed at the four corners of the earth. Positionally, would you think that they're up, they're down, or right there, even with the earth? You know, for example, if I'm holding the pew, where am I positionally? Am I up? Am I below the pew? Or am I equal with the pew? Positionally, I'm up. So if these angels are holding the four corners of the earth, positionally, where would you think that they would be? It would seem that they would be somewhat elevated. It would seem that they were up. You know, when we think about, for example, the sky, you know, that's where the wind comes from. So if they're holding the winds, once again, it would seem like they are up. So I think that helps us a little bit with the picture here as far as the angel ascending. Then you also have some information as far as the great voice. He has a great voice. If you think about the imagery, the great voice makes sense. Earth, a big place or a little place? It's a big place. So if you've got four angels at the four corners, figuratively speaking, of the earth, and you're going to reach them all, how loud does the voice need to be? It's going to have to be pretty loud. So once again, it's not literal, but it is a way, when we think about the symbols, of trying to communicate some great things to us. In this particular case, important creature, and again, very, very powerful. Saying that he came from the living God may be a way of offering a contrast. He came from the living God, thinking about who this book was originally received by. Remember all the paganism? We saw that in some of the VBS videos. They served dead gods, non-living gods. But this angel came from the living God, from the only true God, from the only God that is truly living. Maybe one of the most important things about this angel is that the work that he did. What did he have? What was he doing? All right, let's look at it again. Verse 2, "And I saw another angel, the fifth angel. He ascends from the sun rising. He has what? The seal of the living God. He cries with a loud voice. And he says, I don't want you to hurt the earth. I don't want you to hurt the sea." In other words, man's environment has to stand. Why does it have to stand? All right, we're still doing the spiritual reaping, right? And I think the spiritual reaping is tied in with the seal. What happens when a person is reaped by God? What happens when a soul is harvested?
God heads into the church.
All right. Would we also say that that person is sealed? I think that's right. So that's precisely what we see here. Let's go back and look at some references. We'll pick up three readers. You have a minute to get back to Ezekiel chapter 9. We'll want verses 1 through 8 read. This is probably the background that John draws from. It's not a passage we often look at. We'd like to be our Ezekiel 9 reader. Jeff, okay? Verses 1 through 8. Then we'll also pick up two passages that are more familiar to us. These come from the book of Ephesians. Ephesians 1, verse 13. Who'd like to help us? Steve. And then also from the fourth chapter, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 30. Ephesians 4, Verse 30. All right, Glenda, I saw you first. Thank you. And then we'll also pick up one more. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19. 2 Timothy 2, verse 19. Harvey. Let's start with Ezekiel chapter 9, Jeff, verses 1 through 8.
Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, "Bring near the executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand. And with him was a man clothed in linen, with a writing case at his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of God of Israel had gone up from the cherub on which it rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen, who had the writing case at his waist. And the Lord said to him, Pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sighed and groaned over all the abominations that are committed in it. And to all the others who said in my hearing, Pass through the city after him and strike. Your eye shall not spare, and you shall know no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women, but touch no one on whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the elders who were before the house. Then he said to them, Defile the house, and fill the courts with the slain. So they went out and struck in the city. And while they were striking, I was left alone. I fell upon my face and cried, Ah, Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel in the outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem?
Okay. What do we find here about the mark? You don't have the mark, what happens to you?
Die.
You're destroyed. You're killed. And doesn't matter. We use that same principle today, do we not? Things are marked, and what's marked or what's not marked is destroyed. Ever go down a city street? There's some trees that are marked. And the mark says the X on it may mean take it, or the X may mean keep it, but I mean, hey, that tree's marked. In the spiritual realm, God does a similar thing. He's been doing that for a long time. Ezekiel 9 is a great example. Today, people get so consumed with the mark of the beast. Well, should there be a mark we're concerned with? Yeah. Has God marked us? Has God sealed us? Or, as Bessie said, has God put us in the church? But people often get so consumed with the other, they forget about what's right. But this marking, this sealing is very, very significant. Ephesians 1, verse 13, here's the New Testament version of it.
In him you also trusted after you heard the words of truth, the gospel of your salvation, in whom also, having believed, you were sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise.
Okay, now when we see that word sealed, we probably don't think of the word marked. But I'm suggesting that one seems to be virtually synonymous, or maybe they are exactly parallel. But you've been sealed or you've been marked by God. Well, that's exactly right.
One way that I would think of sealed, to kind of think of it in the same way, you can mark something, you can draw an X on it, or you can put a seal on it, like
right.
A banana or you know, this is a price tag or whatever. That's a seal to me.
Yeah, and you're right. And with seals, you opened up a good line of thought. We talk about the seal of approval. If it's an inspection thing, hey, this is grade A, or we use seals all the time to go ahead and affirm authenticity or to verify something. So you're right. A very, very important part of our world. We just don't connect that with the spiritual realm. So, great point. Therese?
I mean, so similar, like the fair, and they mark you so that you can come back in. If you don't have a mark, you can't get in.
Sure. Okay. The same kind of thing. You know, you're marked. It's an authenticating device. So, we see that all the time. Glenda, are you ready to read, or you have a hand?
In verse 14, it talked about, you know, after being sealed, that it's a guarantee of our inheritance.
Right. The same kind of thing. And we're going to pick up that thought a little bit more with 2 Timothy 2:19, but before we do that, let's pick up with your reference, Ephesians 4, verse 30.
I did not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption.
Okay. Once again, Paul comes back to the idea, midway through the book, you're sealed. And then 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19.
Nevertheless, the foundation of God stands sure, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity.
Okay, isn't that interesting? God knows who?
Everyone.
Yeah, and who his people are. He's not going to miss one. Why not? Well, he wouldn't miss anybody anyway. He doesn't need a literal mark, but it's one more statement from our perspective that, hey, God knows who you are because you've been sealed. Ephesians 1, Ephesians 4, and the principle in Ezekiel 9. Stan?
With that sense it was common to the people, or would have, they would have understood quite well at that time, was the seal or mark. It was a way of securing something. In other words, usually, especially those in authority would put a lot of wax on either the paperwork or on whatever it was, and they would put that seal in there. When God seals us, we are secure. We're protected. There's nobody going to come along, rip the seal off, pull out the contents.
And that's what Jesus said in John 10. You know, if we're in His hand, we're secure. And people have taken that and tried to say, well, that means you can't fall from grace. No, you can choose to break the seal. But if you choose to abide in Christ, then again, you're safe, you're secure. And it's a very, very, you know, we talk about guarantees, and you go back to what we said earlier about authenticity, those kinds of things. Biblical imagery that's very relevant and consistent with the world that we live in. Now, if we've been sealed by God, shouldn't that have some significance for us as we live the Christian life? What about the person who says, well, I'm sealed by God, but I'm going to go out and live as a heathen? That doesn't make much sense, does it? If we've been sealed by God, then as we saw from Matthew 22 a few Wednesdays ago, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with what? All thy heart, all thy soul, all thy strength, all thy mind, all thy might. Well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? If we've really been sealed by God, if we've been set apart by Him, if Paul's correct in Ephesians 1 and Ephesians chapter 4. It also reminds us of Revelation 2 verse 10. Be faithful when? Even to the point of death. Why? Because if God has sealed me, I'm going to love Him this much, even if it requires my physical life. All right, anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Revelation 7:4? Okay. In the fourth verse, we start with some information about the tribes. And I heard the number of them that were sealed. There's that word again. 144,000 sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel. Now, we've said before, especially when we're going through the information about Bible numbers, two of the most well-known numbers, even by people who do not know much about the Bible, are 666 and the number 144,000. Well, 144,000 is found here as well as Revelation chapter 14, verses 1 and 3. Now, if you talk to some people, the Jehovah Witnesses would be one group that would be known for this. They would say the number of people in heaven are going to number how many? 144,000. There will not be one person more. There will not be one person less than that particular number. One of the things, and not everybody's going to agree with this, but one of the things I think that helps counter that is, as you look through this, John describes this same group of people in verse 9. After these things, he said, I saw and behold, who or what? A great multitude. Now this is, as far as I can tell, the same number of people described as 144,000. Now, if somebody gives us 144,000 of, you know, marbles or $144,000 bills, a lot of marbles or dollar bills? Sure. Can we count them? I mean, I think everybody in here would be capable of counting 144,000 marbles or dollar bills. So, if we're dealing with the same groups of people, 144,000, and then we'll come down to verse 9, we see this description, same, then what's that tell us about the 144,000 back here in verse 4? It's not literal. It's a lot greater number. So, once again, I think, and again, the witnesses and some others would not accept this, but they are, I'm certain, this the same figure, just described in a different way, and God apparently put this here to help people realize that, hey, we are dealing with a figure here that is not literal. We've talked several times about the fact that Revelation is a book which is filled with symbolism. That's why we spent two classes going through numerology. Here's what we have up here on the board. So let's kind of go back and put all these things together to get 144. All right. Three, remember, number four, organized religion. You've got how many apostles? 12. You've got how many tribes? 12. So again, God's organizing His people. So again, three or two special numbers, and with this third number, you come out with this special number. All right, if you take 12, this number for organized, what do you do? Remember, we talked about stars. We stay at a hotel. When you add those extra two stars, what are you doing? You're increasing the significance. It becomes even more important. All right, the same principle is used when we talk about Bible numbers. Six means incomplete. Plus on another six, you amplify it. And then you toss on a third six, and what do? You've gone from bad to worse to really bad, the ultimate in evil. Now we've got 100. And we take that 100 and completeness again. Now when you take completeness and completeness and completeness, what do you have? You got real completeness, don't you? So it's a way of saying total entire. All right? Bring that down here. Remember, 144, God, 144.